Hello, and you're very welcome along to this week's RTÉ Rugby Podcast, the last week of Ireland's Quilter Nations series slate, and what a week it promises to be. Ireland, off the back of their best performance yet of 2025, 46-19 winners against Australia at the weekend, and welcoming the best team in the world at the moment, the Springboks, to Dublin this Saturday evening. Bernard Jackman is with me on the couch as usual. Bernard, how are you today?
Very good, thanks. Looking forward to this chat.
And also, for the week that's in it, we decided to bring in a bit of Springbok royalty. 2007 World Cup winning captain John Smith is with us live on the line from South Africa. John, thanks a million for joining us.
Ah, good to be here. Actually, still a day to go before I fly out to Dublin, so we'll be front and centre for what's going to be an epic test match as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to be part of RTÉ's team for our TV coverage this Saturday. I understand you only agreed to do it on the proviso that you would join us on the podcast earlier on in the week as well. Is that right?
A man has to have standards.
Nothing to do with the golf for Guinness that he has lined up.
It was basically backed up on a quick small little Guinness tour as well. So that might have had an overwhelming influence as well.
Well, whatever the circumstances, we're glad to have you. We'll get into the deeper analysis as we go. But Birch, just what a week this is now set up to be, because I think we're all maybe a little bit worried about Ireland. We're looking over the first couple of weeks, and in particular, I don't think we were as worried about Australia, but we were worried about what would South Africa do to an Ireland team that weren't really hitting their stride.
Yeah,
coming into this week, and it's now all set up. We got a really good Ireland performance at the weekend. I'm not reading too much into South Africa against Italy. I'm reading into South Africa against France from the week before. That's the Springboks I'm expecting to come this weekend. It couldn't be set up any better.
Yeah, well, I think it's South Africa against everybody over the last while. I just think they found a level of consistency, which is remarkable, given the fact that they're back-to-back World Cup winners, given the fact that they're blooding some new talent. I think Razzie has this team in a really good place. And obviously now we've dealt with Australia, and there was bright spots in that game, the start and the finish. And regardless of the fact of Australia being tired or not playing well, from an Irish point of view, we needed some confidence going into this game, or else we had no chance. And it's a huge test for us. Springboks are definitely the favourites, and it's going to take a monumental effort to be able to go toe-to-toe with them. But we have a better chance of that now. We've found a little bit of form, a little bit of confidence, and particularly our attack opened up a little bit, because you know we can't defend our way to a win over South Africa. We can't probably set piece and play the kicking game to win over South Africa. We're going to have to find ways of troubling them, and I think from an Irish point of view, it'll go into this game a little bit more confident now after, I suppose, opening up a little bit against Australia.
And John, I think this has become like such a really entertaining rivalry over the last few years, particularly I would say since the South African teams came into the URC, and there's just that greater bit of familiarity. But you look at 2002 at the Aviva, the 2023 World Cup game, and then the two test series down in South Africa in the summer of last year. The second test, I mean, the first 20 minutes of that second test was physicality like I don't think I've ever seen in a game of rugby. It's become a really, really, really intriguing rivalry between these two sides, with a respectful level of dislike, I would say, between them.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, but you've been quite diplomatic about it. And
deliberately so.
Rivalries are built around this deep-rooted respect for the level of what the opponent brings, and I think that's for any country. And we talk about the rivalries of different generations, but you can always gauge how strong the rivalry is by how much South African fans hate your team. And it's actually set in an absolutely positive manner. And South African fans are, I mean, psychotic would probably be a diplomatic way of explaining them. And I think you sort of feel this energy when we're playing against Ireland, because every single one of the people that are wearing these green and gold jerseys that are watching the team understands that there's a real threat of a team that has been number one numerous times over the last couple of years, has beaten them and has beaten the All Blacks and has won Six Nations. And so all of that leads into the fact that this is, it's always been a big test for the last couple of years, and it's still going to be a big test. I love watching how other countries respond when their national teams don't quite perform the way they do. I mean, you look at the absolute panic and pandemonium in New Zealand right now. I mean, it's almost as if the world's about to end. And I saw and read some of the comments around the Irish team after they had lost in Chicago. And it just it's amazing how us as supporters can just go absolutely off our heads every time there's a game that we believe we should win. And we believe, as I guess as pundits and as supporters, that we should win every weekend, whether we're Irish or New Zealanders or South Africans. And so I think it's that fanaticism that creates these massive rivalries, because both sides know they can lose, and both sides want the actual test to see how much better they can be.
It's an interesting point John raises there, Birch. Like, when you look back, if you take Saturday's game into account, were we going a little bit overboard as to how badly Ireland were playing in those first couple of games and slash tail end of the Six Nations?
We were certainly more critical than we would have been maybe 10, 15 years ago, but I think that's a given. That's a given now. I don't think we can keep looking back and saying, oh, sure, aren't we doing great? Sure, yeah. We used to be win spoons. I mean, there's been a lot of investment in Irish rugby. It's a good model. This Irish team are a good side, great coaches. So when they dip below the accepted standard, you have to ask questions, but also understanding and trusting them. So when they say that, you know, the training, what they're doing in the training isn't transferring to the pitch, you got to give them a bit of time to see that. And again, they're quite honest after the game that for the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes, they were doing what they want to do, and then obviously they got a little bit lost. And you don't dominate a test match for 80 minutes against any tier one side. So there's going to be times when you're under the pump. But I suppose because of the age profile of this Irish team, you have to wonder, is that drop in performance levels down to that? And then when you see them bounce back up, like Robbie Henshaw, Tadhg Furlong, etc., shown form of old, then you can actually rest a little bit easier and go, right, yeah, we still have a chance to compete with the best teams. The reality is, if we were blooding a load of youngsters, you'd have to be patient. But likewise, when you have a lot of experience, you kind of expect a certain level of performance. And I think the players themselves admit that the All Blacks game and Japan in the first half were below that. The Six Nations was below that. And they just need to find a way. And I think they hopefully, they do get better in camp with Farrell. And hopefully now it's all geared up to what is the test match this weekend. There's been some unbelievable test match over the last 3 or 4 weeks, but I think South Africa Ireland is the one that everyone around the world are going to be looking at.
Yeah, and like one of the I'd say the main reason, John, we obviously wanted to get you on was to get the South African perspective on Ireland, because last week we had Jonathan Drennan in and got the Australian view of how are people viewing Ireland. And it is always interesting to get the picture of how other countries are seeing us. Are South Africa still viewing Ireland as the team that were a threat to win the World Cup in 2023? Do they think we've maybe gone backwards a couple of steps? How are we being viewed at the moment?
I think there's definitely a view that sees Ireland as the same threat that they were in the World Cup. I think specifically playing at home, and just to add on to the answer previously, yeah, teams like South Africa and Ireland and France, perhaps we exclude the All Blacks out of that for now, just because there's been so much change in the last couple of years. They're from a very consistent background. But you mentioned something earlier around systems, and Irish rugby has got an unbelievable system. I'd like to believe South Africa's got a good system. We've got this turntable of talent that comes through the schooling system, and it's really about how to get the best out of all this talent that comes out and trying not to miss certain players. Ireland's model, which I think is brilliant, around the four provinces and around how they treat international players from outside of Ireland and limit the amount of guys in each position so that there's always three or four Irish players having the opportunity in each position across the board from 1 to 15. It started a long time ago, and it started producing results quite quickly once that system had been in place for a while, and it has been producing sort of results as it's progressed. Like with anything, no coach I mean, you know, coach is going to start off a season by saying, you know what, we've had four or five really senior guys, Peter O'Mahony, you know, retire with a handful of other guys, and it's an opportunity this season to blood some of the youngsters in the mold within we've been working over the last decade or so. You just, that's not how you, it's almost like the kiss of death when you, as a World Cup coach, say, just, you know, don't judge me in the next 4 years, just judge me on a World Cup. Yeah, so supporters don't really buy that. So I think perspective for us, I guess, as pundits or supporters, is around seeing the progression and the success of a model that's been working for so long. And I think that's what South Africa sees with Ireland, and that's why they remain a threat. And that's why Saturday is going to be such an epic battle, and certainly a game that South Africa can lose if they don't bring their best game forward within that 23 players. So I think that the model is one of the most successful. It's super simple and it's super effective, and it certainly benefits Irish rugby's national team. And it's one of the few systems where the tail doesn't wag the dog. So this, it sort of, whether it's the franchises or the club system, everything is geared towards making the national side stronger. And you know, we've been trying to get as close to that as possible, where it hasn't always been the case in South Africa. But I genuinely believe that we're as close to that as we've ever been. And Ireland has been in that space for a very long time. So it's a very long, convoluted answer to a question that is simple to answer. You know, there was always going to be two tests on this end-of-year roster for South Africa that had the potential to derail a season, and certainly had the potential to not come out with full marks for the tour. The beauty is South Africa has been able to blood a few youngsters. They've had some challenges on this tour. They've been able to overcome that. But I think Saturday is certainly going to be a test. I genuinely thought that Stade de France in France would have been a lot closer, and I had some concerns about the result there, but they had an unbelievable day, performance on the day. But Ireland have started building momentum. That result against Australia needs a little bit more talking about, because, you know, we also thought that Australia would be a much easier opponent this year, but they've been very tenacious. They've built something quite special there, and they're certainly going to be a threat in when they host the World Cup in 2027. But that is a you look at that scoreline, you look at that performance, that is a team that took us to the sword in the Highveld in South Africa as well. Granted, again, you know, Rassie played everything. It was one of those days where he was really throwing everything at it. It was the least amount of kicking. We try to play a ball in hand as much as possible, and it worked like a charm. Eventually, I thought this was going to be an absolute thrashing, but Australia stuck at us and kept getting reward from the turnovers and the ball that was spilt from this extravagant sort of new style of play. And they put us to the sword in our back garden, and I think broke a 40, 50-year-old voodoo. So that kind of result gives a team like Ireland a huge amount of confidence. And you look at what probably should have been one of those weekends for us against Italy, but it didn't quite work out that way. You know, we didn't quite get any rhythm. And so it's quite difficult to judge where we are at, other than looking back 2 weeks ago to where they were in Paris.
John, I have a question for you. You mentioned the Irish system and the South African system now being set up as maybe as well as it ever has been. What I find remarkable is obviously you don't have all your players based at home. Obviously, there's been a big effort to get like Sia and Ebden back. But in general, when you see the South African squad, whether it's for a World Cup or Rugby Championship, there's an element of players who are playing overseas. And, you know, you don't control their game time, etc., because they're not centrally contracted. But yet it seems like they come back into Springbok camp and nearly add value in terms of being back in camp, so being back with their home nation, being back with their friends, and then obviously the things maybe they're picking up from abroad. And maybe the weakness in our game is it's everybody's together for a long period, whether that's with the province and Leinster, and then with Ireland. I just, you know, you obviously played abroad overseas, and your own experience and what you see in the Springboks now, do you think there's value to that, to having some players play their rugby elsewhere but come back with that IP and with that freshness, or would you like to see more players play back in South Africa?
So I've got to take my medicine here, because I sat on the board for SR Rugby for 8 years up until March this year, and And when Rassie came to us, you know, as a new coach, and asked us to consider allowing players to play overseas, I guess it was the old school in me sort of that was against it. And our sort of my initial thoughts were, let's preserve our competitions, our local competitions, and let's also, you know, I grew up playing with Gary Tash and Mark Andrews, Oli LaRue, Adrian Garvey, Robbie Kempson, Andre Joubert, and these guys were sort of senior players finishing their careers, and I was a youngster, and they sort of became mentors, and you know, I learned so many lessons. And so I guess the old school version of me was one of the few people that were against it initially. And if I look back now at what Rassie's been able to create, there's a few things that it's done. And you've mentioned it, it allows some of our best players to go and play in the best clubs around the world, in Japan, France, England, all over the place, and learn different tactics, different coaching scenarios, you know, understand different individuals, and get a much better understanding, I guess, of the global game and different views. And there's always a flip side. Coaches also have the opportunity to draw some IP from these players and what they're experiencing in this sort of Rassie Erasmus era. And the second thing, which is probably the most important, is it takes a massive financial burden off our national body. So SA Rugby have got less big names to play for. I mean, the more of them that play overseas, the less they've got to pay them. And what it does do is it opens up so many more slots in our local competitions for younger players to have some kind of exposure. So we've been able to send these established players, and some of them not always established. If we look at Bone Fenter, who's gone over and been picked, and this the hooker as well from the Welsh team, you know, they went overseas probably hoping that they'd be recognised, but we're now making available a lot more spots for this ridiculous conveyor belt of talent that keeps churning out from our school system, and getting eyeballs on a lot more talent that we probably would not normally have been able to see in the past. So there have been a huge amount of positives. There's definitely a negative. If you look at our Currie Cup, which is over 100 years old, it's definitely not the same competition it was 20, 30 years ago. And I think that's one of the, I guess, the negative byproducts of what this new scenario of picking foreign-based players has done. But it's also become a conduit for younger players. You know, we've seen the average age of our URC and our Currie Cup teams dropping dramatically. And that's just been able to expose us to a lot more of the younger talent that's out there.
I might move it on to the games themselves at the weekend, Ireland and Australia, because we kind of need to dig into that performance, which was so much better than what we've seen against New Zealand and against Japan. To go back to maybe some of the frustrations Andy Farrell had been pointing out, some of the quotes he would have come out with after New Zealand and after those Japan games, and I think we can talk about like line out, attacking shape and all that sort of stuff. But I think the fundamentals was the attitude was just spot on right from the start. And you look at maybe the criticisms he had, where he was talking about how they were defending well, but just well, and not having that bit of bite, using the phrase, we were feeling sorry for ourselves, we need to get over ourselves, those sort of things. I think that was the area right from the first whistle where you could see the big difference. And even just isolating the kick chase and the kicking game, for example. And we obviously saw how like Mac Hansen came up with so many brilliant catches. James Lowe had one or two. Tommy O'Brien was brilliant on kick chase as well. And while they won back a good amount of clean ball, I think where it really jumps out is when they didn't win back clean ball, you had players like James Ryan, Tyke Furlong, Thomas Clarkson had one when he came on, Ryan Baird. People just... It was Irish jerseys were consistently first to those breaking balls on the ground, diving on them like pigeons on a spilled chip. It was ravenous energy right from the start.
Yeah, there was a massive difference in terms of intent. I think that was why he was so frustrated against both the All Blacks in Japan, because even that first 60 minutes when we were leading, there was no real dog or kind of loose abandon where you're just throwing your body in places that normally you wouldn't, and kick chase ferocity and all that, all those things that probably the stats don't tell you, work right off the ball. And that was back. There was an intent there. We weren't going passengers against Australia. We were driving the car, and we obviously got reward for that quite quickly with two tries. But it wasn't just ferociousness or aggression. It was skill set and like being able to attack space. So the two Mac Hansen tries came from not just playing front door, being willing to move the ball. And
we saw a lot more forwards passing.
We did. But the thing is, like, we were we weren't just being passive in our carries. We were carrying to the line. Our support play was bang on in terms of our shape, and we were willing to move the ball. And when Ireland moved the ball well, they're very, very hard to stop. It's when we're quite direct that we're actually quite limited, because we're not as big and powerful as some of the other teams. So all the things that he said he wants was kind of a given that we're missing, we're back. And yeah, it made Australia look very limited. But it started with Ireland. It started with Ireland wanting to win that test match and not be, as I said, just passengers in the game. They wanted to take control of it. So it was much better. And then you add to the fact that we won a lot of area ball. And we can't take away from the fact that we had a lot more possession from good source of possession, i.e. line out, our scrum was solid. And then winning those aerial balls back when the defence are in chaos, it makes it so much easier then to go play.
John, on the...
I've got to add on to that. I mean, also just as a person that's been watching this Irish team, and I also have had the privilege of being coached by Faz, who also I think is a phenomenal human being in terms of what he's been able to create and all the teams that he's coached. Yeah, one of the things that stood out for me at Saracens when he was there was, you know, it was very little criticism around errors. I mean, obviously, you make enough errors, you'll end up getting dropped. But it was never real talk about errors. There was always a talk about effort level. You know, Smalley and Faz, they kept banging on about if you made a mistake, it was just the next thing, it was next job. And effort level was the thing that was being judged in that environment. And you can sort of see that coming through in this Irish team. And there's a couple of things. You talk about that front foot. And you look at just how Hansen made that sort of shift to fullback. And it's because he's got this front foot ball that is running onto. And he's got this time and space, because there's a few things that they do really well. Set piece is a given, so they've got a really good scrum, really good lineouts. And the second thing is they are really accurate and painfully frustrating at the breakdown. They, if it's theirs, they're efficient and they don't overcommit. The ball comes out nicely. If it's the opponents, they're all over it like a rash. It becomes this, well, now we've got to throw an extra man in because there's this attention to the sort of ruck ball. And the third thing is they don't give a lot away for free. When they're playing well, they have this sort of unwritten law of attrition where the less mistakes they make, the less opportunity is for the other team to get energy and regain some momentum. And we saw all three of those things in abundance against Australia.
Just to go back on your time working with Andy Farrell back at Saracens, it was obviously the very early days of his coaching experiences back at Saracens. But would you have got a sense back then that obviously you're not going to predict this guy's going to be coaching a test level for X number of years and he's going to be a Lions coach? But did you get a sense straight away that, okay, this guy has it in terms of coaching? He's going to go a pretty far way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was blown away by the environment, to be fair, and there was just so many things about it. The coaching setup, it was one of the biggest coaching setups that I'd ever, you know, been a part of, and every single guy there had just was good at what they did. Faz played a very, very senior role in that team at the time, and so it was he had a lot of face time with the team and a lot of influence over how we played. And yeah, you could see not just Faz, but there were a number of coaches that I believe would certainly go further. But Faz really has done incredibly well. I think his journey with Ireland has been brilliant. The fact that he could switch over and lead a successful British and Irish Lions tour adds to his mantle. And he's a proper Northerner. I don't think he's the kind of guy that's ever going to get ahead of himself. He's always going to think that he can work harder, and that will always end up flowing over into the teams that he coaches. You know, it's such a difficult thing to manage as a player and as a coach is an ego as well. So to keep that thing in check and to make sure that you're always working harder and always trying to think of different ways to get better and innovate along the way, that requires a sort of an internal battle with yourself as a coach to continue to sort of, you know, keep your feet on the ground and keep looking for where the leaks are in the boat.
Just he actually tells an anecdote about that time. It was Justin Marshall there when you were there, John?
No. I was just thankfully just after Marshall's time. I have to endure Marshy in the pub at World Cups, which it's in itself is a massive challenge.
Yeah, I've had that experience as well. But he tells a story that he was quite young into his coaching career, and obviously it was just after that. But he thought he had to keep reinventing the wheel, and I think Marshy eventually called him in and said, look, Faz, just be yourself, you know what I mean? And like we play for you, like just keep it simple, be yourself. And he stopped then trying to keep reinventing himself. He's got a growth mindset, but he just stuck to the things that he felt were important. And Marshy said, Farrell says it's one of the best things he ever learned as a coach was just to keep it as simple as possible.
Well, has he reinvented Mac Hansen as a test level fullback? That's the next question. I know the Bucks are an enormous step up from Australia, but do you think just having Mac Hansen at fullback, we've spoken about the kick chase and all that, and I think those things are a given, but just if you look at the three tries he scored, he didn't necessarily have to do a huge amount in terms of making line breaks or anything, and the first two were simple run-ins, but the other argument is, as a fullback, he has to have that ability to slip into the line almost unnoticed, and he seems to have a fantastic ability at doing that, of picking the running lines, of slipping in when no one notices.
Yeah, I think in a modern game where space is at a premium, your fullback, if he's an attacking threat, has an unbelievable role to play. And I think Mac, for us to beat the Springboks, if it's just an arm wrestle, we lose, right? Now, you can't avoid an arm wrestle. You're going to have to, at times, you know, dig in. But for us to be able to have a chance, realistic chance of beating them, we have to fire shots, and our shots aren't going to be around just physicality. They're going to be having to play to space, and someone like Mac who can beat people, someone like Mac who can counter attack from kicks onto him or kicks long kicks into the backfield has to be a valuable addition to this team this week, particularly with Hugh Keane out. So yeah, I think he definitely obviously starts, but I think he could be a key player for us if we're going to have any chance of winning.
We've also got an out-half situation to talk about, and it's actually now two out-halves playing pretty good
rugby.
It's
good.
Sam Prendergast was probably his best performance, might have been his best performance in an Ireland shirt. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. But on top of it then, he plays an hour, Jack Crowley comes on, and might have been a little bit of pressure to perform. He was excellent in that final 20 minutes as well. He was really trying to push things. He some of his contestable kicks were just as good as Sam Prendergast were early on as well, and people had that ability to win ball back. What does it come down to this weekend? Does Jack Crowley's physicality in a tackle just about give him an edge in this game?
Yeah, I think you'd probably start with Jack and then Sam to come on like he finished the reverse last week. I think the main thing is both of them now look really comfortable, on form, confident. They have different skill sets, and hence you can mix and match a little bit. I'm not sure when we have two of them, we're going to have the outright dominant 10 we had with O'Gara, with Sexton, with Humphreys. Certainly we need a number one, but there'll be certain games where one skill set gets them the nod to start. I would think that Jack would probably start because of obviously the threat that South Africa bring. But depends. He may want him to finish as well, and I thought he did really well. And our best period was probably we looked very comfortable with Jack at 10 as well. I think the fact that everybody else knows their role a bit better and the details a bit better, it's much easier to play 10 now than it was even start this November series.
John, how do you see Ireland's out half situation at the moment, where you have two guys going for, and obviously in South Africa you have your own situation going on where it's probably three between Andre Pottenaar, Manny Leibach and Sasha Feinberg and Gamazulu?
Yeah, I think it's almost exactly the way Bernard he explained it from an Irish point of view. I think it's sort of become, and I think Ireland and South Africa are both in the same position when it comes to the pivot. It's horses for courses. How do you want to play? Who you're playing will depend on what you select. I mean, I fascinated to see who he goes for this weekend between Sasha, Andre, and Marty. And if even more so as to who he puts on the bench. You know, I guess Ireland got to make a decision about, they've got two really good fly halves, and you know, sometimes you, against South Africa, a lot of teams can get lulled into trying to make decisions around physicality rather than a decision around how they want to play and how they believe that that style of play will get them points on the board early. And I think Ireland need to be able to put points on the board early if they want to have a real shot. And then maybe it becomes an idea of, do we start with more flair in the beginning and close shop with a bit more of consistency and someone who can sort of handle that attack should someone be chasing, should the box have to chase? Or do we sort of concern ourselves with the physicality and put someone a little bit, maybe a Crowley at 10 and try and stop the physicality threat? I genuinely believe the teams that have done the best against Africa have not made decisions based on physicality. Physicality is always there every single game. It is the one thing that determines momentum. But everyone's got physicality. I mean, we haven't seen South Africa absolutely walk over Ireland in the last 3-4 years from a physicality point of view. You know, that threat is more around how does your defensive system deal with the big ball carriers and the offloads from an Archer, for example. But I genuinely believe that Ireland need to make a selection, specifically a pivot, that suits the way that they want to play, and rather than adjusting to what physical threat might come from South Africa.
It is a really interesting one this weekend, because Prendergast played brilliantly in the first 60 minutes of that match. The kicking was outstanding, constantly giving the likes of Mac Hansen, James Lowe, Tommy O'Brien chances to come down and win the ball, or at the very least knock it back for Ireland. And some of the attacking link-up play, like some of the handling for those first couple of tries, was really quick and sharp. But when you saw Len Iketau barrel him over for that first try, or when he dives and gets knocked off by Daguna down the wing, it was hard not to think about, what if that's Eben Etzebeth running straight at him next weekend?
Yeah, and look, obviously Iketau is very powerful, but the problem for Sam at the moment is it's the one-on-ones, and like every team is trying to get two men hits as often as possible. There's certain times where a player gets isolated, and just his conversion rate in those needs to be a bit better. And I can totally see John's point. You don't want to get overly obsessed about the opposition, and you got to play your game. And I think Ireland will want to play, and Sam's attacking game is very good. I think they'll probably go with Jack, with Sam to finish, and both can implement our attacking game. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a fascinating one, because whoever obviously plays 60 minutes or whatever this week has an unbelievable chance then to go into the Champions Cup break as probably number one.
On to John's point again about not getting overly worried about thinking about physicality and playing your own game, but putting that logic to a different position as well. I'm interested to see what happens this week at Loosehead Prop, because to be honest, last weekend I thought Andrew Porter was the most impactful he's been for a good while, coming off the bench for that last, was it 30 odd minutes or so. And I thought Paddy McCarthy was excellent for those first 50 minutes. Look, save for that the second try just before half time, but that's not a major fix. That's just kind of getting to grips with Test rugby a little bit. I'd be curious to see, are you getting that same level of impact off Andrew Porter starting the game, but also are you getting the same level of impact from Paddy McCarthy coming off the bench? Do you still expect Andrew Porter to be starting this weekend?
No, I think there's a strong chance Paddy McCarthy will start. One, Porter hasn't been in amazing form. I thought he looked better, as you say, coming off the bench.
I thought it was the best game he's played for a good while,
for sure. And he's had a lot of game time, obviously, a lot of consistency at starting for Ireland. But I think if you start Paddy McCarthy, two things: one, you really have used this November to increase your depth, and you've tested him against the best. Okay, so you test him against a good Australia scrum, but you test him against the best, against South Africa. But two, I think in terms of refereeing, like, this scrum is going to be an unbelievable contest. His scrummaging is a lot tidier than Andrew Porter's. There's always been a lot of scrutiny on Andrew Porter's body angles, etc. And sometimes that's been costly. World Cup and quarterfinal against New Zealand is an obvious example. But you know, you take away that if you can, and also Paddy McCarthy makes it very easy for Dan Sheen and Tadhg Furlong because he stays nice and tight and compact. So it's easier to probably pin that scrum with Paddy McCarthy at the moment. And also, as I said, you may get more out of Porter coming on. So I think that'd be a very brave decision, but I'd love to see it happen. Now, but this is the counter argument is this is the best scrum in world rugby.
Yeah.
And do you want to have a young guy making a second start play loose head? But I'd actually go with it.
John, this seems like something straight out of Razzie Erasmus's playbook, doesn't it?
I was just about to say, we're getting to the good stuff. All the fat guys up front here. I think it's such a difficult. We talk about blooding players, and this is probably the most difficult place to blood youngsters or guys that are looking to get test experience in the front row, because it's like Mortal Kombat up there. You know, you send in a guy in the centres, and you put a nice experienced guy either inside or outside of him, or you put a nine in, and he's got a really experienced 10. You can help a guy out, but you know, it's Mortal Kombat right at the front there. So, and again, you know, the coaching staff of Ireland are going to have to decide, because there's probably two contenders for that number three shirt, and one's going to play 50 minutes, and the other one's probably going to play 30 minutes. And it's between Vulcolo at 138 kilos and then probably Thomas De Toy at 132 kilos. It's a difficult weekend to experiment with a loose head. So we've tried from blooding a new titan in this tour, and you know, I guess through the red cards, it hasn't quite worked out for him. And you know, as soon as he got exposed when we were a man down, we had to make some changes just to make sure that we don't sort of destroy his start of his international career, because he's got such a big future. And so coaches have to be aware of this, specifically in the front row, because you know, I started as a youngster and I got bent like a pretzel many, many times. And you start to think that this is just the way that it goes. But it is a hard, hard place to be able to, you know, blood someone from an experience point of view.
It is. It's such a fascinating position at like test level, where it's just a rite of passage that, as John said, you are going to get bent like a pretzel a couple of times earlier in your career. And you kind of have to go through it to learn.
Yeah, I don't remember John getting bent like a pretzel too often, and he obviously played at the top level at hooker and at prop. But I think the fact that another advantage for McCarthy is he and I know Porter does as well, but he would have experience of scrummaging with Dan and Furlong, with Leinster training, etc. So you're not even it's less of an experiment or less of a risk to bring someone in from another province. There's continuity there, you know, from last week. I think the challenge would be if Porter was under pressure in the scrum, is bringing on, you know, a young new set then. I think you're better off maybe having your experienced guy potentially on the bench this week. Just, John, we're not anywhere near as radical as you guys are.
I think you've got a point there. I do think that makes sense. I'd rather give him a full go with fresh legs and see what damage he can do and how much impact he can have. And leave sort of Porter as your. I mean, if I was the coach, I'd probably think exactly the same way.
Mm. Just well, on, you mentioned the red cards there, John. I think we're going to have to talk about that. It was
next on the list. It's funny. I was going to lead it off by saying it's going to be a lot of this game will be dictated by how many players are still on the pitch. With the way South Africa played against France, I'm not sure if it even matters. But I think we do have to play it, because I talk about it, because it has been a talking point. Two straight red cards in consecutive weeks for South Africa against France and against Italy at the weekend. They're appealing, both of them. Lou Diaga got a 4-game suspension off the back of his red card against France. Franco Mostert will have his hearing this week, and South Africa said they'll be challenging that red card he picked up against Italy at the weekend. Some interesting quotes from Zondele Stick speaking in Dublin yesterday, just talking in general about how they have been reffed. Are we being treated fairly? I don't think so. I don't think we deserve this as a team. Surely somewhere, somehow, this is not fair. It's a tough one to break down, I suppose, mainly because we have seen so few straight red cards in the last 12 months, ever since the the TMO bunker came in, it is sort of become an automatic that every incident with a bit of head contact has become a yellow card, gone to bunker for review, either stays a yellow card or it gets upgraded to a 20-minute red. This feels like pretty much the only two instances, or in a tackle area at least, in the last 12 months, yeah, that we've seen straight red cards.
When this came out, we were told straight red was there for acts of real violence, like a punch.
Deliberate was the word that was used.
But like the interpretation I was given was, you know, a headbutt, a box, yeah, a gouge, a kick. I'm really shocked that the straight red was given for both these. I can see Diager to a certain extent, but I thought Mossart. I think Mossart will be off. I genuinely think he will get off. I think there's loads of mitigation there. It's not even that clear that it's head contact. That was a strange decision. And two international referees who aren't Irish were WhatsApping me during that game about that, and they were like shocked. They were shocked. And again, like, referees make mistakes. I think that was an error. Obviously, if you're South African, you think there's a bit of a conspiracy theory because it's happened back to back. But I think Mossart will be clear, to be honest. That's my good feeling. I think Jäger will get banned, or is banned. He might get reduced to two games, whatever. But my good feeling is that Mossart was an error by the referee.
Your thoughts, John? I know you posted on Twitter either this weekend, either the weekend just gone or the weekend previous, essentially saying you don't even know what is a card or what isn't a card these days.
I was actually going to start with that. I mean, I took to social media. I think it was against the first red card. Also just, I guess, not so much around the fact whether or not it was head contact or not, just because it was such an easy decision for the officials to make, to go straight to the red without having sort of a look at the sort of going for the upgrading it to a red, only to find out that, you know, if you do give yellow and put it to review, then the player, whether guilty or as no matter how guilty he is only going to be able to have 20 minutes off the field,
mm-hmm,
which I still think protects the spectacle or the test match for the spectators' point of view. But anyway, that's beyond the point. I realized that I don't know enough, and I didn't, of all the things I saw with 6'5" humans trying to get as low as they possibly can, both on backs that were, I guess, had already lowered, it looked as if it was they were trying their absolute best to tackle within in the laws. Look, I think Lert, when you hit the head, there's got to be some consequence. I think with Mostert, I think the whole world, other than the three referees and the involved, realizes that it wasn't head contact initially. And then again, it's just, I guess, frustrating for supporters. I watched a whole bunch of internationals, and what you don't want, and it's starting to feel that way, is that every sort of time they go like this, everyone's like, oh my goodness, this could actually go anyway. This is like a bit of a lottery. And rugby's such a hard game to referee because there's so much going on all the time. And maybe it's not actually about how these moments are being treated. Maybe it's something that's always been a bugbear of mine. The game has become so much more financially viable for players and for coaches and for broadcasters. And if we really dumb it down, we've got to maybe look at, from a global point of view, what is the most important thing in a business? It's probably having the right CEO. And we've got these referees, and it's a tough job. It doesn't matter who – someone's always going to hate you if you're a referee, because there's always a losing team. And so it's a very difficult job because you're looking at it, thousands of things that can go wrong just in one breakdown. The rules change all the time, so they've got to stay up to date. And then the frustration from the fans are that they don't get educated on the new rules. And so we as pundits say stupid things on social media. And so the pressure just is unbelievably high on these referees, who are the CEOs of this business of 80 minutes between 23 players on each side and a coaching staff on each side. And yet they're the least paid person on the field. And our expectation of them is we need more from them than what any player or coach is bringing. But we're basically putting all of our hope into someone who's got the most important role in the game, but he's the least paid person on the field. And I think that's probably fundamentally where we need to start focusing our attention. The frustration amongst fans and coaches and players is been there for a long time. But maybe we're looking at this from a wrong viewpoint. Let's invest more in our refereeing. Let's pay attention to probably the most important part of the game, which is the adjudication. And I'm not sure we're doing that.
Yeah, I think at the moment the problem is it's the number of red and yellow cards seems anecdotally to have spiked in this November internationals. You saw Eddie Jones after the game, and obviously they lost the match, whatever, and there might be a bit of sour grapes there, but the game was affected by lots of refereeing decisions, and probably not a massively no dangerous act, I would say, intentional act of any of them, you know.
I would point out, for me, that Josh Adams one was a permanent red card. Yeah, that wasn't a 20-minute red.
No, but the problem is you're not getting any consistency. Like John, me, you watch a lot of rugby, and when it goes to the TMO or the big screen, we really have no faith or idea that what we see and adjudicate to be the correct punishment will happen. There's one area, one thing we may need to look at is basically copying the NRL and go on review. You know what I mean? So basically the game, if it's as such, isn't affected to the level it is now with red cards, etc. But with time on a Tuesday or Wednesday, with the cold light of day, with lots of angles, that a punishment can be passed.
But even when it comes to that, when it comes to the punishments, I would say most of the disciplinary stuff we end up talking about on this podcast, it's not about was this a yellow or a red card at the weekend. It was how did we get 4 weeks rather than five or six out of this suspension, and the mitigate, you're getting 2 weeks off for this and this. The post match disciplinary, I suppose workflow isn't particularly good either at the moment.
No, it's not, but at least it's not maybe affecting a test match. So we're all going to be in Aviv on Saturday. If someone ends up having head contact, which we obviously got to try and stamp out of the game because somebody slips or someone's knocked into their path through another tackler and there's head contact, do we think and the good feeling or decision made afterwards was like if say Mossert's let off, right? Say Mossert's let off and that was an error by the referee, and we'd see if it was. Effectively, that could have affected that test match, right? And that's the challenge. When you're not getting what you feel is consistency of decision making, maybe you're better off actually looking to see. Obviously, we can upskill the referees, but that could take a while. Maybe you're better off taking it out of their hands a little bit and out of the 80-minute block for test rugby and entertainment. That's something we may need to look at.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to jump in here, and also again maybe contentious, but I also think that because it's such a difficult job and there's not a massive line of people stepping up to and dreaming of being referees of international rugby, these reviews and these committees that have to make decisions around whether it is 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, is it rescinded, I think subconsciously also feel like they need to defend the decision of the referee on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And probably maybe they're right as well, but there's definitely it's almost feels like it's the game versus the referees, and we don't want that to be the case. We want the referees to be as celebrated and as built up as any of the players. But at the moment, it's sort of all panning out to be sort of, you know, this sort of the referees, you know, and there's this negative groundswell towards referees in general. And that, I think, is something we need to sort of stamp out. And the only way to do that is actually to give them more power, give them more technology, give them more options, and certainly make those big moments a bit easier. You know, if they're going to straight red because they believe it's thuggery or they believe that it was always illegal, you know, maybe we need to just change the fact that everything should go to review. And if it was thuggery, the guy stays off. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like difficult things to do to take pressure off the referees. But right now, there's three guys out there with the whole world watching them, and they're trying to make the best possible decision in front of a home crowd that probably is trying to sway the decision. We've got to try and find ways of making it easier and taking some of that pressure off the actual guys in the arena.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for the referees themselves out on the pitch at the moment, because I think when the 20-minute red card was introduced last year, the wording of it did nothing to help them, because as we said at the start of this conversation, the word deliberate was used in there. It was for deliberate acts of foul play. And I think if you look at both Franco Monstert and Lou Diager's incidents in the last couple of weeks, they were reckless. They were, well, certainly the, I think Lou Diager's one just with the tuck shoulder was particularly reckless. I don't think it was deliberate in any way. Mm. There wasn't necessarily maybe mitigation or something like that. But so maybe have the referees been told, okay, there's a new interpretation of what this is and it hasn't been communicated to the public properly. And also then as well, in the moment on the pitch, because a bunker review can't be upgraded to a permanent red card, they essentially have to decide in that moment whether or not it's upgraded to a red card. So the most important decision of all, can this player be sent off for the entire game? That actually can't be sent to the person who has 10 minutes to sit down and review the incident properly. They have the bunker official. The bunker official can only decide this is either a yellow card or it's a 20-minute red.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's wrong. That's a failure in the system.
Yeah. And surely if you're going to have a bunker official, they should be able to look at that and go, do you know what? That is worthy of a full red card. You're gone for the game. I do not see how that isn't part of the process at the moment.
Well, I think we got to challenge it as pundits. And I think the coaches are. I think the problem you have now is that coaches and players, it's already stressful to play a test match, right? So you can imagine the Springboks and Ireland in the tunnel walking out to the Viva on Saturday evening. They're stressed. There's the pressure of a nation on their shoulder. They're also stressed about the officialing. Stressed about being sent off because of an accident, you know. And that's the fear. And you want to take away as much stress from players. They prep all week. They prep their whole life to be ready. Let's not have them stressed about decision making around the laws of the game. And it's an area that needs improvement, and that's fine. It's understandable, but let's make sure we try and make it better.
Maybe one of the final. Go for it, John.
Rob, so I think, and the other point again, and I'm going to come in defensive of the referees, which I like to do because I do think they're under the pump and unnecessarily. So we as a game, rugby isn't doing a fantastic job of growing spectators. It's a difficult game to understand. So you bring someone to a game and you've got to explain the rules. It's a pretty complicated game. And we haven't done ourselves any favors over the last couple of years with the frequency of rule changes and the tweaks to certain things. You know, the three of us here probably have just in our explanation, have probably got something wrong purely because we've missed a law change that preceded these November tests. And I think we need to address that from a growing of popularity in terms of new spectators to the game. That I think we're missing the boat there, because we're already in love with the game and we're sitting here sounding pretty frustrated. Can you imagine trying to sell this game to a set of eyeballs that's never seen a game of rugby in their lives before? It would be pretty tough.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting at the weekend. We'll finish on a positive note. Finish with a couple of predictions on a positive note. Everyone finishes with 15 players. There's no cards. We're having a great day. How is Saturday going to go? Final predictions, I suppose.
I think the Springboks, I think they'll squeeze us. I think their bench will be phenomenal. Expect Ireland to score and score plenty of tries. But unfortunately, I think once the South Africans get into the 22, you saw against Australia, our ability to deal with that power game from an attacking point of view from Australia, we were left a little bit short. So yeah, I think Springboks will win probably 26-22, maybe. Yeah, 26-22.
And John, it's been mentioned obviously that Ireland is the one country Razzie Erasmus hasn't won a test match in. Do you think that actually does nag on him, that is a motivating factor, or is he happy enough with his couple of World Cups?
I definitely think it'll play in the back of his mind. You know, he speaks unbelievably fondly about his time as a coach in Ireland. And I think he'd want that from a personal point of view, as much as he wouldn't put it on the team. I do think that it's a box he'd like to tick, like any other coach, to be fair. And he's, you know, he's done well. He's built a group of players, not just a team. And it'd be very hard to bid against them, certainly in their current form over the last season. Well, 4 or 5 seasons, you know, they really have been consistent every single time. I think that they're sort of, because every team's got this cycle, you know, and these cycles come and go, and it always depends on experienced players retiring and who comes in their place. But he's been able to extend the cycle much longer than any other coach I've ever seen. And that's a difficult task in a South African context. So I've learned my lesson in terms of not betting against South Africa. They are in a good space. Dublin hasn't been a happy hunting ground for them, and so they'll be even more motivated by that. This is a team that likes to overturn records and get wins against their name. So, yeah, I do think South Africa have probably got enough to do the job on Saturday if they bring what they've been bringing the last couple of weeks. But if they're a little bit off, this Irish team can certainly give them a really good go.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Probably the best game of the weekend. You've got Wales, New Zealand, 3:10 on Saturday. Ireland, South Africa, 5:40. France, Australia, 8:10, as well as Italy and Chile. And then on Sunday, Scotland versus Tonga, 1:40 p.m. And England, Argentina, 4:10 kickoff. A reminder, live coverage of Ireland and South Africa on Saturday from 4:30 on RT2 and RT Player. Bernard and John will both be part of that coverage as well. And listen to live commentary on RT Radio 1 also. Bernard, thanks a mil for joining us. And John, safe trip. Hope you have a safe flight. And we'll see you later on in the week in Dublin. Looking forward to having you part of the RT coverage. And for everyone on the podcast, we'll speak to you again soon.